simply had to give him the only answer he could. I assumed if the president wanted you there, you would be there. But he and Lyndon Johnson had had so many years together. I'm sorry, he said. I should have talked to you before I went in to see the president. While he had apologized, however, the fact remained that the president hadn't wanted Johnson there. The arrangements for a major political event that the administration was holding in his state had been made, and he hadn't been told about them. Chapter 10. The Protégé. In October 1963, also, there was gathering over the darkened landscape of Lyndon Johnson's life a thundercloud even more threatening than those already overhead. The first faint rumble of the approaching storm had come on that Scandinavian trip, on Friday, September 13th, in Copenhagen, just after he had returned to the Royal Hotel from luncheon at the palace with the Danish king and queen. It came in a telephone call from Walter Jenkins. Reporters didn't know about the call. All they saw was that, as Bart McDowell of the Associated Press was to put it, on that day in Copenhagen, there was a change in Lyndon Johnson's personality, a great change. There were changes in his schedule, too. Whatever plans there were on the docket for him, he scratched and spent the entire day locked up in his room. Several times that afternoon, Reedy emerged to deliver announcements. The trip was being shortened. The press of business in the United States made it impossible for Johnson to visit Greenland on Monday, as had been planned. The Greenland trip was canceled. The vice president would be returning to the United States a day earlier than had been scheduled. Those would not be Reedy's last announcements of schedule changes. A full-dress inspection of the Danish Navy scheduled for Saturday was canceled, as were other events for Sunday, so that, as a Danish newspaper put it, an official guest could hardly see less of Denmark. On Sunday, in fact, the vice president didn't emerge from his suite the entire day. Reedy told newsmen that, as one of them recalls, Johnson had remained in his bedroom, closed the door, and spent the day on the telephone. "We assumed that it was heaven knows what," McDowell says. Reedy tried to scotch rumors that the vice president was ill or exhausted from the trip, but the press of business was the only explanation he had been authorized to give. "We were just in the dark, totally," McDowell says. Sunday evening at 8:25, Johnson finally emerged from his suite with Lady Bird, his entourage behind him, for the lone event that day that had not been canceled. A visit to Copenhagen's famous Tivoli Gardens amusement park, where he was to appear with the Tivoli marching band. His lips were pressed into a thin line, and his eyes were narrow and hard. He had spent the whole day on the phone, and when he finally emerged to march in this light-hearted parade, he was obviously very grim and preoccupied, McDowell says. The mood of the people walking behind him reflected his. You could sense a change in the whole party. No one in the group said a word as they walked downstairs to the waiting limousines. His expression hardly changed during the parade. It would have been a festive scene as the band, colorful in white trousers, red jackets, and tall black bearskin shakos, its tubas and trombones glinting in the light of bright lanterns, marched through the park's gaily colored thrill rides and turreted mock castles, playing lively tunes. Except that the tall man in an overcoat striding with it was as grim as a pallbearer. Though the Greenland visit had been canceled, there was still a visit to Iceland scheduled for Monday, and a formal state dinner given by Iceland's prime minister, and Johnson had been scheduled to fly back to Washington on Tuesday, arriving in the evening. But he told the State Department aides who had been rescheduling and rescheduling the trip that it was very important that he get back to Washington earlier than that, and he left the dinner early and took off Monday night, setting down at Andrews at 1 o'clock in the morning. The call had been about Bobby Baker. On September 9th, Ralph Hill, the president of a firm that installed vending machines for coffee, candy, and cigarettes in factories and collected the profits from them, had filed a lawsuit in United States District Court in Washington against another vending machine company, the Serviu Corporation, and against Baker. The suit alleged that Baker had taken $5,600 from Hill to use his influence with the defense contractor North American Aviation Corporation so that one of its subcontractors would allow Hill to place his vending machines in its plant, and that Baker had then turned around and persuaded the subcontractor to oust Hill and replace his company's machines with Serview's machines. That Baker had thus, as one writer later put it, taken money to use his influence with a defense contractor and had then double-crossed the man who bought him. Jack Landau, a reporter for the Washington Post who covered the district court, was given a tip that there might be something interesting in the suit. The matter seemed minor, a dispute over a contract between businessmen, and Baker, an official of Serview, assured Landau, had no connection with the company, and it was later to be recalled there was considerable initial soul-searching by the Post's editors over whether to run a story about it. But it had finally been decided to do so, and on Thursday, September 12th, while Johnson was in Scandinavia, the story was published, buried inside the newspaper's city section, but with the headline, "Senate Official is Named in Influence Suit." A couple of Post reporters were assigned to look further into the matter, as were a reporter or two from other papers, and by Friday morning reporters had started calling Jenkins, which is when he telephoned Johnson in Copenhagen. And by Sunday, the day Johnson spent the entire day in his room, the day he became so grim and preoccupied, Jenkins had other news to report. The reporters had come across the fact that the vending industry's trade journal, Vend magazine, had been looking into Serview for some time and, in fact, was about to run an article on the company in its next issue. And the article's author, G.R. Schreiber, had allowed the Post to see the article on condition that the newspaper not print any of its material before the magazine appeared, and the reporters, having seen it, had begun calling Jenkins with more serious questions because, Ben's article said, with detailed documentation, that Baker, whom the article identified as the protege of Vice President Lyndon B. Johnson, was, despite all the assurances, not only connected with Serview, but was in fact one of its stockholders, and, in addition, had substantial business dealings with the company. That the company, which had been founded in December 1961, had enjoyed remarkable growth in the less than 2 years it had been in business, that in fact its annual gross income, the income of this firm intimately connected with a Senate employee whose salary was $19,611 per year, was at or in excess of $3.5 million, and that every cent of that amount came from companies that were in the aerospace industry, and that were all sizable contractors with Uncle Sam. And Vend reported that Ralph Hill's suit alleged that Baker had obtained the vending machine contracts for Serview because, as Secretary of the Senate Majority, he was able to and did represent that he was in a position to assist in securing defense contracts. In view of the phenomenal growth of Serview over a 20-month period, in a handful of plants owned by corporations who do billions of dollars in business for Uncle Sam, Vend said, the question of any relationship between Serview and Baker needs an answer. What Johnson was doing behind the closed door of his suite in Copenhagen was telephoning and panicking. He panicked on Bobby, George Reedy was to say. He absolutely panicked. He was scared, timorous, in Reedy's word. The way that man could panic, and when he panicked, he had this animal instinct, cover up. With reporters badgering him for an explanation for the vice president's day-long seclusion in his suite, Reedy tried to tell Johnson he had to give them some explanation, but the response was a shout, "Don't say a thing!" When Reedy has always tried to reason with him, Johnson said, "Don't tell them a thing!" and went into his bedroom, slamming the door in Reedy's face. Johnson telephoned Abe Fortas, who had gotten him out of some of the tightest spots in his career, the federal judge's decision to hold hearings on the vote counting in the 1948 election, for example. But those had been legal difficulties. Fortas was indeed what Johnson considered him, one of the sharpest of lawyers, but this new problem was at the moment a public relations problem, and public relations was not the area of Fortas's expertise. When, however, he gave Johnson advice that fit in with the cover-up instinct, Johnson followed it. Fortas suggested that reporters should be told that he, Johnson, really wasn't all that close to Bobby Baker, and never had been. That Baker had been selected as Senate Secretary not by Johnson, but by vote of all the Democratic senators. That, in fact, he had hardly seen Baker since he had left the Senate. "Oh, my God, that was incredible," Reedy was to say. "That was just stupid. Abe was the one who came up with this. All the Senate Democrats elected Bobby Secretary of the Majority. Well, for the love of God, they all elected him because LBJ told them to." And, of course, everyone knew that. While Reedy didn't have to deliver the line himself, at least not for a while, the reporters who were accompanying Johnson in Denmark knew nothing about the matter. Johnson telephoned Jenkins and told him to take that line with the reporters asking him questions in Washington. Meanwhile, he told Jenkins, he was rushing home. Jenkins had received one call that was particularly disturbing. Harry Province, editor of the Waco News Tribune and an editor who had been working closely and subserviently with Johnson for years, had telephoned from Texas to say that one of the reporters who was looking into the lawsuit had already written a draft of a story about it and had sent it to him. The reporter, 53-year-old Sarah McClendon, wrote a column that ran weekly in the News Tribune and six other Texas newspapers, and was also a one-woman news bureau who submitted articles to newspapers around the country and to a small New York-based wire service, the North American Newspaper Alliance, in hopes that they would publish them. She was regarded by the rest of the Washington Press Corps, in the words of one article, with a mixture of derision and respect, the former for her practice of shouting down other reporters at presidential news conferences in a loud, shrill, gravelly Texas voice, and asking accusatory questions that were all too often based on conspiracy theories, the latter for the courage she displayed in her struggles to make her career and support her daughter. Her husband had abandoned her when he learned she was pregnant, as a woman journalist in Washington at a time when the National Press Club didn't even admit women. She didn't know how to be discreet, her colleague Andrea Mitchell was to say. She was as aggressive as hell. Objectivity was not her concern. That was bred from years of having to be outrageous to be heard. And while her stories were sometimes filled with overstatements and unsupported generalizations, this time her story was understated and filled with facts. McClendon's article did not merely give the details of the lawsuit against Serview. It identified one of Baker's co-defendants, Fred Black, as a lobbyist employed by North American Aviation for the purpose of securing contracts from the United States government, and said Black had worked with Baker to do that, and her article was not limited to the suit or to Serview. It reported that the Senate employee was operating other businesses as well, businesses of a varied nature in Washington and South Carolina. It reported that he had built and operated the Carousel, a motel in Ocean City, Maryland, that was a recreation spot for top officials of government. Nor was it limited to Baker's private business interests. He was, the article said, one of the chief dispensers of lush Democratic campaign funds. And, it said, Baker was Johnson's protege and close personal friend. Province read McClendon's article to Jenkins over the telephone, and then Jenkins had the editor dictate it to a secretary, and then Jenkins either read it to or discussed it with Johnson in Copenhagen. And at about 5:30 on Monday, about the time that Johnson was boarding his plane in Iceland for the flight back to Washington, Jenkins telephoned Ms. McClendon and asked her to come to his office in the Senate office building, and, she says, when she arrived, took the line that Abe Fortas had laid out. "We have your story," he told her. "We know that you've been trying to peddle it all over the country for days." "The story was just not true," he said. "Baker is no protege of Mr. Johnson. Baker was here before Mr. Johnson ever arrived in the Senate. Mr. Johnson hasn't seen him in ages. Mr. Johnson has barely seen him since he became vice president. He never sees him on social occasions or otherwise." Ms. McClendon says that Jenkins ordered her to stop trying to peddle the story. "We know you're trying to get it out. We want you to stop. You are not to print this story." It was no use trying to get it out, he said. Telephone calls had been made. The impression he passed on to me was that no one would print the story, that all lines of getting the story out had been closed off. She'd better stop trying to get it out, he said. I was given the impression that if I persisted, my bosses in Texas were ready to act. Jenkins's statement that Ms. McClendon had been trying to sell her story was correct. She had sent it to all her other Texas newspapers. His statement that no one would print it was correct, as far as Texas was concerned. Every one of her Texas clients had rejected it. But, she says, while Walter knew what papers I worked for, he didn't know about, or had forgotten about, the North American Newspaper Alliance, the little wire service in New York. Feeling that, in justice, she owed it to the wire service to tell it that there might be consequences if it sent the story out to its subscribers, she went straight from Jenkins's office to her telephone in the Senate Press Gallery, glanced around to make sure that no one could overhear her, and called the service's editor, warning him that he'll, Johnson, make trouble. He's going to make an awful lot of trouble. The editor said it was too late to stop the story from going out. It's already on the wire. Only one newspaper, the Des Moines Register, printed it, but on Wednesday, September 18th, there it was, on the Register's front page, and the next day the Charleston, South Carolina Courier picked it up, and the Chicago Tribune assigned its top Washington correspondent, Willard Edwards, to it. And on the 23rd, his article ran. Not only did it contain the story of Baker's ties to Serview, whose rapid growth made it the talk of its industry, it also contained the same phrase McClendon had used, Lyndon's protege. And that same day, Vend was published. It was, as one account put it, one of those rare instances when a highly specialized trade journal became a newsstand sellout in Washington. And suddenly not a few, but a pack of reporters were investigating the case of Bobby Baker, and the next Monday he was in a national magazine, Newsweek, its headline calling him the Serview Man. The text had an amplified identification. Bobby Baker, it said, was so much the protege of Lyndon Johnson that he is known as Lyndon's boy. The case that had brought Baker to national attention had no direct connection with Lyndon Johnson, and possible connections would never be definitively explored. The only senator who would ever be directly linked with Serview was Robert Kerr, one of whose banks had, before his death, made a major loan to the company. The only journalistic references to a possible connection would be hints. All of Serview's contracts were with plants in the aerospace industries, and among several hats worn by the vice president is that of chairman of the Space Council, or gentle sarcasm. It is, of course, only accident that Lyndon Johnson is chairman of the National Aeronautics and Space Council, and that Bobby Baker is his protege, Murray Kempton wrote in the New Republic. And it was also, of course, possible that Baker had been invoking Johnson's name without his consent or knowledge. Johnson did his best to keep such hints to a minimum by, on the record, silence. "Don't tell him a thing," he kept saying to Reedy. The single sentence Reedy was authorized to give to reporters was, "No comment on a matter pending before court." And, off the record, denials. "Just trying to sell that line that he hardly knew Bobby Baker," in Reedy's words. "You just couldn't sell that ridiculous story," Reedy says. Johnson kept trying to sell it, however. Reedy was to recall one horrible session at which he had to watch as Johnson denied to reporters a relationship which they, often in company with Reedy, had witnessed year after year with their own eyes. The vice president also stopped communicating with Baker, never speaking to him during this period and ordering his aides not to speak to him. The single telephone call from the Elms that Baker received, late one evening, wasn't from the man with whom he had, for years, right up to the time Johnson left on the Scandinavian trip, spoken almost daily. "Bobby," Lady Bird Johnson said, as Baker recalls the conversation, "Lyndon and I just want you to know we love you. You are like a member of the family, and we are so grateful for all you've done for us. Our prayers are with you." Then she changed the subject. No sound came over the telephone line to indicate that anyone was in the room with Lady Bird, but Baker was sure someone was. "I knew while she was talking on the phone, he was lying right beside her listening," he was to say. He understood the reason for the call, he was to say. It was to keep him friendly. He probably was concerned that I might become miffed at his inattention and say something harmful to the detriment of his career. He's using Lady Bird to soft soap me. And, he was to say, he knew the reason for the silence. I was thinking, LBJ's right there by her side, but he won't talk to me because he wants to be able to say that he hasn't. It was very important to Johnson that he be able to say that, Baker says. I knew Johnson was petrified that he'd be dragged down by being connected with him, and Baker says there was valid reason for Johnson's concern. If he had revealed their many connections, Bobby Baker would say, Lyndon B. Johnson might have incurred a mortal wound by these revelations. They could have driven him from office. He lied. He knew exactly what I was doing. Johnson would be able to go on saying that for quite a long time. From the moment in Copenhagen that he learned of the lawsuit, until, almost exactly 10 years later, Baker visited him for a day at his ranch in October 1973. We spoke not a word, and communicated only through intermediaries, and even through intermediaries very rarely. Lyndon Johnson didn't speak to Bobby Baker during the years before 1967, when Baker was convicted of larceny, fraud, and tax evasion in an unrelated campaign funds case, and sentenced to 3 years in prison, or during the years in which Baker was appealing the conviction, or when Baker finally went to jail. And even on that ranch visit, there were moments hurtful to someone who had so worshipped the man he called simply leader. When in 1973, Walter Jenkins telephoned to invite him and his wife Dorothy to the ranch, he included the caveat that this is to be very private, no publicity before, during, or after. Meeting the Bakers at the Austin airport, Jenkins quickly ushered us into his car as if eager to hide us. At the ranch, Johnson tried to create an atmosphere of old times, but Baker noted that Johnson wanted to know about the memoir he had contracted to write. Is it going to be one of those kiss-and-tell books? And when Baker asked him to put in a kind word for me with the Justice Department, which was investigating him again, I don't want to go back to jail, he turned cold. As the Bakers were leaving, Bobby noticed the ranch guest book on a table by the front door. He knew how insistent Johnson was that every visitor sign the book. He stood there until it became too obvious that my old leader wasn't going to ask him to sign. No matter how completely Johnson cut himself off from Baker, however, he couldn't do so in the press. Baker was, of course, his protege, Lyndon's boy, Little Lyndon. Any new revelation about Baker, and the new revelations would come fast upon each other's heels, including the fact that according to a financial statement he filed in 1954, the last financial statement he filed before Johnson had him elected majority secretary, his net worth was $11,025, and in 1963, according to another financial statement he filed, it was $1,791,186, would reflect upon Johnson himself. The man most harmed by Baker's fall from grace is his longtime sponsor, Vice President Johnson, Doris Fleeson wrote. And while no direct connection may have existed between Johnson and Baker's activities with Serview, there were connections between him and Baker in other areas. And when Johnson was leafing through the Washington Post on the morning of October 6th and reached page B6, ever since the first story by Jack Landau had appeared in the city section, he had taken to looking through that section as well as the national section every morning. He realized that at least one of those connections was about to come to light, for the article contained the name of Don B. Reynolds. Reynolds's name was there because a senator had begun looking into Baker's business dealings, from Johnson's point of view, the worst possible senator. Although John J. Williams, a Republican from Delaware, was not a junior senator, in 1963 he was a year away from completing his third term and was the ranking Republican member of the Senate Finance Committee, No senator could have been more isolated from the Senate's ruling inner circle, because he wanted it that way. Williams hadn't been a politician, but the owner of a livestock and poultry feed company when, in 1946, at the age of 42, he decided to run for the Senate. Arriving in Washington, he shunned the social circuit that politicians frequent. Reinforcing his appearance of shyness was his demeanor on the Senate floor, where his voice was so soft that it was often inaudible to reporters in the press gallery, who gave him the nickname of Whispering Willie. A tall, spare man with, as one journalist put it, friendly lines grooved at the corners of his mouth, he soon had a reputation for fierce independence, although, as one account was to say, Washington folklore holds that any Delaware politician jumps when DuPont snaps its fingers in Wilmington. He opposed and defeated a proposal that would largely have freed DuPont stockholders from taxes on a particularly profitable company transaction, and although a rigid conservative about social mores, he voted to censure Joe McCarthy because he disapproved of his methods. The niche he carved out for himself in Washington was an unusual, perhaps unique one. Becoming curious about complaints that something was wrong in the Wilmington office of the Internal Revenue Service, in 1949 he launched an investigation, not through a Senate committee with its attendant glare of publicity, but largely on his own, that went on for 3 years. And by 1952 it resulted in no fewer than 125 convictions for bribery, extortion, and falsification of records. During the years since then, he had conducted more investigations, again not through Senate committees but on his own, relying on information supplied by the Government Accounting Office and on tips from men and women in the government. Of all the scandals involving Harry Truman's cronies that had marred his presidency, none resonated more with the public than the one involving Truman's old friend and military aide General Harry Vaughan, described by the press as perhaps the ultimate White House crony, who helped obtain government contracts and favored treatments for businessmen and accepted from one of them and arranged for another to be given to First Lady Bess Truman, an expensive food storage deep freeze. Although Vaughan said the freezers were merely an expression of friendship, and although there was nothing illegal in what he had done, the deep freeze had in headlines and cartoons come to symbolize the mess in Washington. Williams, who spent 3 years looking into the Vaughan situation, was to add a dimension to the story. It wasn't only businessmen who had benefited from Vaughan's influence, he revealed, but businessmen associated with the underworld. During the Korean War, one of them had been given a government post solely upon Vaughan's recommendation. And during the Eisenhower administration, Williams, although he was a Republican, had been one of the first senators to demand the investigation of, and then the dismissal of, Eisenhower's assistant president, White House Chief of Staff Sherman Adams, who had intervened with federal agencies on behalf of Boston textile magnate Bernard Goldfein, and who, the investigation revealed, had accepted expensive gifts from Goldfein, including an oriental rug and a vicuna overcoat. Williams seemed not to care where his investigations led. One was into the overseas junkets taken by members of Congress, which didn't increase his popularity with his colleagues. But while the Senate inner circle and the reporters who crowded close to it and seemed to regard themselves almost as a part of it sneered at Williams, journalists of a more independent bent had made his qualities known to the public. His performance has not included TV spectaculars, the New York Times was to observe. He has no power of subpoena. He has no sleuthing staff, no special counsel serving as prosecutor. Yet, as the Times wrote, by his investigations, Senator Williams has perhaps brought down more wrongdoers operating in the United States government, or chiseling from it, than any other man. A growing army of men and women confide in Senator John J. Williams, Doris Fleeson wrote. Thanks to these journalists, Whispering Willie was not John Williams' only nickname. He had another one, the Conscience of the Senate. The fiery investigative reporter Clark Mollenhoff of the Des Moines Register, who admired him, as much as Mollenhoff could admire anyone, said that despite the softness of Williams's voice, what he said usually echoed with a roar through the entire federal government. and in late September, Williams had begun an investigation into Bobby Baker. He did so in his usual low-key manner, inviting Servius Ralph Hill to his office and asking him for the names of other persons he could speak to if he wanted to learn more about Baker's business interests. And then he started inviting these people in, and one of them was Don Reynolds. The October 6th article contained Reynolds's name only on a list of persons Williams had interviewed, identifying him as an insurance broker from Silver Spring, Maryland. It gave no hint of what subjects he had discussed with Williams. But Johnson knew what subjects Reynolds might be discussing with Williams, and it would turn out was indeed discussing with the senator. Reynolds told Williams that in 1957, having been advised that a political connection would be helpful in building up his insurance business, he contacted Bobby Baker, a fellow South Carolinian, and they entered into an agreement under which he would make payments to Baker because, as Reynolds was to put it, of his social contacts and his wide knowledge of people whom he could present to me. Baker had shortly thereafter introduced him to Walter Jenkins. Johnson that same year had mentioned to Baker that he was having difficulty obtaining life insurance because of his heart attack, and Baker, as he would recall, told Senator Johnson about my partnership with Don Reynolds, and we agreed to seek the policy through him. Reynolds secured Johnson $100,000 of insurance. In 1961, the amount would be increased to $200,000, whose premium, he learned, would be paid not by Johnson, but by the LBJ Company, with the checks signed by Lady Bird. And when Reynolds obtained the policy, Baker brought him to the lobby outside the Senate chamber so that he could hand it to Johnson personally. Johnson told him jovially that, as Reynolds was to recall, he was going to rib his big-shot friends from Texas, that with all their insurance company connections, they were unable to insure him, and a country hick came up here from South Carolina and got it for him. Reynolds, Baker was to say, was delighted to be doing business with the big man. The delight was soon to fade. Reynolds never spoke to Johnson again, but he did speak to Jenkins, because Jenkins called him in to tell him that in return for being allowed to write the policy and obtain the commission, about $2,500 per year, he would be required to purchase advertising time on the television station in Austin, KTBC-TV, when, Reynolds said, he protested that it made no sense for a Maryland insurance broker, unknown in Austin, to advertise on television there. Jenkins said that didn't matter. Baker, Reynolds said, prodded him to buy the time. And after Reynolds made the purchase, buying $1,208 of airtime, another type of purchase was required. The Johnsons wanted a new stereo set, Baker told Reynolds, and Reynolds would have to supply it. Reynolds did, obtaining catalogs from various companies and giving them to Baker to give to the Johnsons. Lady Bird selected a Magnavox S-44 model in a cherrywood cabinet, an expensive set selling for about $900 in stores. Reynolds managed to buy it wholesale through a friend for $542.25. When Lady Bird wanted it delivered quickly for a party she was giving, he had it delivered air freight, which cost an additional $42.50. Although Jenkins would later deny again and again the advertising time and stereo set demands, Baker would confirm them. He, Johnson, took the stereo, and he required Don Reynolds to buy the advertising. It was a kickback, pure and simple, he was to say, as would Reynolds, who called the demands a shakedown. And when Williams asked Reynolds if he had proof of what he was saying, Reynolds produced it and brought it to the senator's office. The invoice from the Magnavox company for the stereo to be shipped to Senator Lyndon B. Johnson and billed to Mr. Don Reynolds. The canceled check signed by Reynolds with which he had paid Magnavox. The canceled checks, one for $1,000, one for $208, signed by him that he had written to the Johnson television station for advertising, on the back of which were stamps showing they had been deposited to the account of the LBJ Company. The television checks are made out to the KTBC Cable and Television Station and the Mid-Atlantic Stainless Company, Inc. because Reynolds, in an attempt to recoup some of the $1,208 he was being forced to spend for advertising that could have no possible benefit to him, had resold part of the advertising time to the Mid-Atlantic Company, a manufacturer of pots and pans. While these transactions were illegal, insurance laws in both the District of Columbia and Maryland prohibit an insurance salesman from sharing with a policyholder any commission or premium he collects, laws designed to prevent kickbacks or rebates being used by brokers as an inducement to buy insurance. They were small in amount, although Baker was to write, "That was precisely my point. You may be thinking that Senator Johnson spent a great deal of time and effort to clear a very modest profit." He did indeed. He was always on the lookout for the odd nickel or dime. They nonetheless made clear the crucial connection, documenting the link between Baker and Johnson that Johnson had been trying so desperately to deny. The kickback on the insurance policy that Baker had arranged had been demanded by Baker not for himself, but for Lyndon Johnson. Dealing with Little Lyndon had meant, in at least one instance, dealing with Big Lyndon. The invoices and checks proved that. According to Reynolds's statements to Williams and according to the written evidence that supported them, the Bobby Baker story was also the Lyndon Johnson story. And while a stereo set was a small item in the great scheme of public life, was it any smaller than a freezer or a vicuna overcoat? Johnson had held a front row seat at both the Truman Crony and Sherman Adams scandals, had seen a cold storage container and an overcoat wreck the reputations of two prominent officials, drive one of them, a man second in power in the executive branch only to the president, out of government. In a way, the fact that freezers and vicuna coats and top-of-the-line stereo sets were minor but expensive items, the type of material possessions a newspaper reader could visualize and relate to and wish he could afford to buy, made them political bombshells that could do as much or more damage as revelations of much more significant transgressions. Lyndon Johnson was very well aware of what an expensive gift could do to a political career. The whole Bobby Baker case, in fact, had unfortunate echoes of the Truman scandal, including the fact that each had had a memorable noun for the headlines. Protégé was a word with an unfortunate ring to it, like crony. "He hated that word, protégé, just hated it," George Reedy said. "Every time he saw it, it just seemed to drive him up the wall." No one outside Williams's office was yet aware of what Reynolds had told the senator, even really that Reynolds had any significant connection to Johnson at all. But from the moment Johnson saw Reynolds's name, says Horace Busby, he knew the statement the insurance broker might be making and how damaging they might be to him if they ever became public. "He knew it in a moment," says Busby. "It was trouble." More important, small an item though the stereo gift might be in itself, its disclosure might open up questions about Lyndon Johnson that were not small at all. The premiums on Johnson's life insurance had been paid by the LBJ company. There had been speculation for years about Johnson's relationship to that company. Lady Bird had purchased one small radio station in 1943 for $17,500. Since then, thanks in part to a 20-year-long string of strikingly favorable rulings by the Federal Communications Commission, which, among other aspects, had left Austin as one of the few metropolitan areas with only a single commercial television station, the company had burgeoned into a chain of immensely profitable radio and television stations the length of Texas, and by 1963 it owned as well 11,000 acres of ranch land and major shareholdings in 9 Texas banks. Johnson had quieted the speculations by his unequivocal denials that there was any relationship. He had said over and over for 20 years that the LBJ company was entirely his wife's business and he had nothing to do with it. That, as he claimed in one of many such statements, "all that is owned by Mrs. Johnson. I don't have any interest in government-regulated industries and never have had." But if Lyndon Johnson had no interest in the LBJ company, why was it taking out insurance on his life? And, of course, his denials had omitted the salient fact that Texas was a community property state. And therefore, since Lyndon Johnson had an interest, a half-interest, in all the company's income, he had become rich. If Reynolds' statements became public, it would cast doubt on Johnson's claim that there was no connection between LBJ and the LBJ company. And once that connection was established, the company's financial dealings would become a subject of journalistic inquiry. Johnson had arrived in Congress poor, and during his career had ostensibly had no source of income other than his government salary. He had been boasting to friends for years that he was a millionaire, which indeed he was, several times over. By 1963, he, a man who had never held any job but his government positions, whose salary had never been more than $35,000 per year, was not merely a millionaire but a millionaire many times over. But that fact had never become known to the press or the public. How would it look if it did? Furthermore, once reporters started looking into the LBJ company, they might look not only into its wealth, but into how that wealth had been accumulated. And one area of that accumulation, the key area, was particularly vulnerable to journalistic inquiry, precisely the area with which Don Reynolds had been involved. The insurance broker had been forced to buy advertising time that he didn't need on KTBC-TV in return for receiving something from Lyndon Johnson. This had long been Johnson's practice, and as readers of the second volume in this series, Means of Ascent, may recall, and if they don't, they can look on pages 101 through 106, what they were often receiving, often getting in return for their payments, was Lyndon Johnson's political influence on their behalf. They had been buying, he had been selling, political influence. Sometimes the payments were made not in cash, but in kind, in material things that Johnson wanted for his home in Washington or for his ranch, in what KTBC's general manager, Earl Deeth, called trading out. A stereo was only one of many such items traded out. Deeth was to recall television sets, large sets, the newest model, enough of them for both the main house and the guest houses Johnson was building on his ranch, as well as tractors and cars. It was a means of getting material things without paying for them, he explains. And, Deeth says, there was so much of it. Johnson, he says, lived in fear that such dealings would be exposed. He just lived in fear of that, and I think rightfully so. He had been involved in so much. The Bobby Baker thing made this fear very real, says Deeth. Johnson had traded out with so many people, he says. What if one of them came forward with a statement to the press? And if Reynolds' statements became public, would others be encouraged to come forward? Reynolds was, in his talks with John Williams, opening up other areas as well. He was telling the senator about campaign contributions Baker had made. And as it happened, on the very day, October 6th, on which the first article containing Reynolds' name appeared, there was another development. One of the senators to whom Baker had offered a contribution that year came forward voluntarily to talk about it, and about what Baker had wanted in return. No sooner had he arrived in the Senate in January 1963 as a newly elected senator from New Hampshire, then Thomas J. McIntyre was approached in the Democratic cloakroom by Baker, who, McIntyre said, told him, "I understand you have some campaign debts. Well, I have a few friends who would be willing to pick up the tab." McIntyre did have debts, $17,000 worth, but decided to check with an older senator before accepting the offer, and was told, "Don't touch it, or you'll be in the bag to the oil interests." McIntyre's statement, he was to issue a formal typed version, was self-serving. The important point here was that I did not accept the offer because of the possibility that such a sum of money was coming from a single source, it said. And its timing was interesting. As Newsweek was to comment, the exchange between Baker and McIntyre might have been lost, but it cropped up because Bobby Baker is in trouble. Trouble especially titillating because he is so widely regarded as Lyndon Johnson's protege that he is known as Lyndon's boy. To Johnson, the disturbing point was that Baker's role in the dispensing of campaign funds had made an appearance in the public gaze. These funds, startlingly large amounts of money and much of it in cash, had been raised and dispensed at Johnson's direction. How long could it be before his role was in the public gaze as well? The Senate's reaction to the Baker revelations had been indignation at the fact that someone had had the effrontery to make them. Baker had not been asked to resign, Majority Leader Mansfield told reporters on October 4th. He had not offered to resign, and there was no reason he should resign. "Bobby's work in the Senate has been excellent," he said. "The other matter, Serview, affects his activities outside the Senate." Even in that other matter, he said, Baker might vindicate himself. "We will not attempt to prejudge it." Some senators tried to duck reporters. Majority Whip Humphrey, cornered by the Associated Press shortly after a visit to Mansfield's office and asked if they had talked about Bobby Baker, replied, "Not entirely." And others, even Wayne Morse of Oregon, usually as far outside the Senate establishment as Williams, tried to defend the eager little man who had done them all so many favors. Speaking, "For once with the united voice of the Senate," as Murray Kempton put it, Morse said on the chamber floor that Bobby Baker performed many effective services for each and every one of us. I am not going to walk out merely because a friend may have made mistakes. Williams kept bringing Mansfield and Republican leader Everett Dirksen reports on what his interviews were turning up, however, and Mansfield asked Baker to meet with him, Dirksen, and Williams on Monday, October 7th, to give his side of the story. And on that morning, Lyndon Johnson didn't have to leaf through the Washington Post to find the story he was worried about. There it was, big and black in a headline that stretched across the top of the front page. Baker called an influence probe. Bobby Baker knew what his side was. Had he talked, he was to write in his memoirs, many senators would have found themselves in highly embarrassing circumstances, to say the least. And so would the man he revered. The wound Johnson might have incurred by his revelations could indeed have been mortal, he said. They could have denied him the presidency or driven him from office. Shortly before the meeting was scheduled to begin, he resigned, and the next day the storm broke over the front page of every major newspaper in the United States. And almost every article, it seemed, not only contained the word that Lyndon Johnson hated, but gave short shrift to his contention that it had not been him who had raised Baker to power. "Baker is a protege of Vice President Lyndon B. Johnson," the Washington Post explained. "Johnson named Baker to the position of secretary to the Senate majority. At the time, Baker was 26 and still at law school." Theirs was a close relationship, Mary McGrory explained to the readers of the scores of newspapers that ran her column. During the 1960 campaign, it was he, Baker, who put the yellow rose on the record player, and Mr. Johnson, to please Bobby, made a long detour to a South Carolina mountain hamlet called Rocky Bottom, where Bobby was greeted triumphantly as a native son who had made good. Baker had hoped, he was to say, that his resignation would make the affair magically disappear from the front pages and come to a grinding halt. But nothing could have been further from the truth. Declaring on the Senate floor that the integrity not just of Baker but of the Senate is involved, Williams said the case cannot be closed by resignation, and introduced a resolution calling for a Senate investigation. The Senate had little choice but to pass it. Although it had been expected that the investigation would be carried out by the Senate Permanent Investigations Subcommittee chaired by the hard-bitten Senator McClellan, it was referred instead to the Rules Committee, a decision which, as Newsweek said, had old Senate hands chuckling. "The Rules Committee has as its most weighty duty approving Senate press passes." The committee's chairman, 67-year-old B. Everett Jordan, a first-term Southern conservative from North Carolina, was slow-talking and slow-thinking. Even Baker had to say he was something of a bumbler. In contrast to McClellan, one columnist was to say, "He is as hard a negotiator as Neville Chamberlain." Not only had he been an admiring, indeed subservient, Johnson man during Johnson's time as majority leader, moreover, Jordan had been a Bobby Baker man as well. He was fond of telling how much he had relied on Bobby. Asked how he had spent his first day in the Senate, he said, "Oh, I went over to the Senate chamber and I stayed there until Bobby Baker told me I could come home." Although he now hastily removed it, an autographed picture of Bobby had hung in a prominent position on the wall of his office. And he was almost immediately to confirm fears that, as one columnist delicately put it, he is too soft-hearted to head the investigation, by postponing indefinitely what the Chicago Daily News called the logical first step in a hard-hitting investigation, a request to examine Baker's income tax returns and the sworn statements of his assets that he had given to various federal agencies. But Williams was still conducting his own independent investigation, and so now was a whole pack of reporters, and all through October there was a drumfire of disclosures in the press. That Baker was a partner not only in Reynolds's insurance business and in the vending machine company that was the talk of its industry, but also in a travel agency and a law firm. That the Carousel wasn't the only motel in which he had an interest. He was a partner in one in North Carolina as well. That he had, not a month before the investigation opened, moved from a modest home to a $125,000 mansion in Swank Spring Valley, near the home of Lyndon Johnson, where, the Chicago Daily News reported, a Chinese houseboy fends off callers. And then, as the month was coming to an end, and October 1963 was drawing close to November 1963, the stories began growing bigger and bigger. For the Bobby Baker case, it was revealed at the end of October, had every ingredient necessary for it to become a scandal of truly major proportions. Not only money, it was turning out, but sex as well. During the last week of October, newsmen searching through District of Columbia real estate transactions had discovered that Baker was the owner not only of the Spring Valley house, but of a Capitol Hill townhouse, one that was occupied by shapely 24-year-old blonde Carol Tyler of Tennessee, a former Miss Loudoun County, who had been Baker's administrative assistant before he resigned, and who had continued as his mistress. And they discovered, and began to print, at first in hints and then more openly, that at the townhouse, chain-smoking, martini-drinking, party-loving Carol, and a group of other attractive young women, were assigned to dwell and entertain in all-night parties, at which Baker's high-flying circle of acquaintances entered and left through a back door. Headline writers named it the Party House. And a party house was, innuendo-wise, thin gruel beside another venue that, over the weekend of October 26th and 27th, began to appear in newspaper stories as part of the Bobby Baker case. It was a small hotel, the Carroll Arms, situated not 100 yards from the Senate office building, just an ice cube's throw from the Capitol, as one article put it. On its second floor, the stories said, was an intimate club, a discreet little private club, smoky and dimly lit, a spot where the ceiling is red and the lights are low, an intimate and elegant gathering place named the Quorum Club, that Baker had, the stories said, organized for romantic caucuses of senators, lobbyists, and congressmen. And there were stories also about the caucusees, the young women, the hostesses or party girls, the articles called them, in a euphemism for call girls, and in particular about one of the hostesses. For those who didn't prefer blondes like Carol Tyler, this one was a brunette, and on any scale of scandal material, she was off the charts. Clad, as one account put it, in a brief revealing skin-tight costume and black net stockings, sultry dark-haired, dark-eyed Ellen Romich, the spectacularly exotic and sensual-looking wife of an East German army sergeant, had worked at the Quorum Club and at the Carousel Motel for more than 2 years before, in August 1963, she had been expelled from the United States and hustled back to East Germany, because, as Clark Mollenhoff reported that weekend in the Des Moines Register, she had been associating with congressional leaders and some prominent new frontiersmen from the executive branch, and because of fears that she was an East German spy. As it happened, Lyndon Johnson had no more association with Ellie Romich than he had with the Quorum Club, which had not even been established until after he left the Senate. He was not even a subject of her boasts. The official with whom she was rumored to have had sex was John F. Kennedy. Apparently, she had bragged that she had had sex with the president, and in July 1963, an informant had reported the boast to the FBI, which was already investigating rumors that she was a spy. The agency's suspicions fueled, as one account puts it, by her expensive lifestyle, which, the FBI investigators concluded, hardly could have been maintained on the pay of a German Army enlisted man. The FBI had found no evidence to corroborate either rumor. A summary, written in July of its preliminary inquiries, concluded that investigation has not substantiated the security allegations against subject, nor does she apparently have the high-level sex contacts she originally boasted of. Not a week earlier, however, Harold Macmillan had resigned as Prime Minister of Great Britain, brought down by the Profumo affair, in which the British Defense Minister John Profumo was caught in impropriety with a call girl who was also the mistress of a Russian naval attaché, a concatenation of circumstances that raised the specter of security breaches. The parallels between the Profumo affair and the rumors about Ellie Romich's White House connections and about her spying would turn her boasting into a big story if the press got wind of it. Robert Kennedy, who, as Evan Thomas puts it, from the outset understood that the merest whiff of a sex and spies scandal could be threatening to the president, had in August arranged to have her quietly deported, and the matter had appeared closed. If she had no connection to Johnson or Kennedy, however, Mrs. Romich certainly had one to Bobby Baker's club, and now, with Baker big news, she was news too, and she certainly had the figure, 35-25-35, and face, an Elizabeth Taylor look-alike, one reporter called her, and apparently sexual proclivities, lesbian prostitute was how Mollenhoff described her in his notes. The German Defense Ministry was to mention her somewhat nymphomaniacal inclinations. Another source said simply, she would do anything. To elevate a scandal to new heights. Oust beauty to head off D.C. scandal was the New York Daily News story that Sunday. A beautiful German beauty with a lusty yen for men was rushed out of the country in August after bragging about affairs with important Washington figures, informed sources disclosed tonight. And with reporters tracking down every fact and rumor about her, how long could it be before the identity of the most important Washington figure of all was in print? Hill probe may take Profumo-type twist, was the Washington Post headline over a story that promised a spicy tale of political intrigue and high-level bedroom antics when the Senate Rules Committee took up the Baker case that week. Robert Kennedy headed off the threat to his brother. On Monday morning, October 28th, he asked J. Edgar Hoover to persuade Senate leaders that the Rules Committee investigation should not include sexual matters, and Hoover, meeting with Mansfield and Dirksen, did so, assuring them that none of Romich's or Bobby Baker's activities had anything to do with national security. The Attorney General may have had to guarantee the FBI director that his job was secure to persuade him to do it, but nothing could head off the threat to Johnson. Romich was undoubtedly linked to Bobby Baker, and Bobby Baker was Lyndon Johnson's protege, and the issue of Life magazine that landed on newsstands during the first week of November had Baker on the cover, and inside, illustrating a story headlined "The Bobby Baker Bombshell," was not only a full-page photograph of Bobby and Lyndon grinning together in their Senate heyday, the caption was "Leg Man and Leader," but on the page facing them, two other photographs, one of Ellie Romich, one of Carol Tyler, the brunette hugging some sort of fluted upright object, the blonde bouncing out of ocean surf in a white bathing suit, every inch the beauty contest winner, that guaranteed the attention of at least the male portion, and in the case of Ms. Romich, perhaps a part of the female portion, too, of Life's 30 million readers. On October 30th, Lyndon Johnson had attended Tom Connolly's funeral in Marlin, Texas, flying to Waco, the nearest city with a sizable airport, and then continuing on by small plane to the little town. All during Johnson's years as a congressman's secretary and a congressman, and into his first term as senator until Connolly retired in 1953 at the age of 76, at the end of his fourth term in the Senate, Connolly had been a great power in Washington, chairman for almost a decade of the Foreign Relations Committee, as well as an icon in Texas. His frock coat, string tie, black hat, and great mane of silver-gray hair, familiar in every corner of the state. A man to be courted and feared. As a newly elected senator in 1948, Johnson had made a pilgrimage to Marlin to solicit Connolly's help with committee assignments, and had been careful not to take offense when Connolly patronizingly refused it. Johnson had told his staff never, under any circumstances, to antagonize him. But in 1963, Connolly had been retired for 10 years, and the turnout of officials at his funeral was slim. Although Presidents Kennedy and Truman had sent elaborate floral arrangements, the presidents weren't there themselves, and neither were any senators or congressmen, not even the representative from the local district. After the funeral ceremony in Marlin's First Methodist Church, mourners filed past the open coffin, and when it was Johnson's turn, the line stopped as he stood looking down at Connolly's face. He put on his glasses and continued looking for a long moment, and then walked out of the church. And the harsh Texas sun spotlit his face, on which was written a depression so deep that Posh Oldtorf, who had known Johnson for many years, was shocked. After following the coffin to the cemetery and watching it being lowered into the ground, Johnson came to Oldtorf's house. "I think it's a disgrace that there was no delegation there from Congress," he said, as Oldtorf recalls it. "As powerful as he was and with all he had done, if he had died when he was in office, you wouldn't have been able to get into Waco for all the airplanes." "I had seen him low before," Oldtorf was to say, "but I'd never seen him that low." And having heard Johnson tell him more than once how meaningless a job the vice presidency was, how only the presidency meant anything, Oldtorf felt he understood Johnson's feelings. Tom Connolly had been a powerful senator, but no one remembered him. Lyndon Johnson had been a powerful senator. He was thinking he would never be president. And no one would remember him either. In early November 1963, the exact date is not clear, Senator Williams asked Reynolds to come to his office again, and Reynolds told him about another insurance deal. In the spring of 1960, Reynolds said, Baker had invited him to a meeting in the Capitol at which the upcoming bidding for the contract to construct a District of Columbia stadium was discussed. Present were the chairman and the chief clerk of the House District of Columbia Committee, and Matt McCloskey, the contractor and Democratic fundraiser who had been active in the 1960 convention and then had been named Kennedy's ambassador to Ireland, and who now announced, as the others in the room already seemed to know, that he was going to be one of the bidders. Baker told McCloskey that Reynolds was his business associate, and that if McCloskey won the contract, he would like to have McCloskey consider retaining Reynolds as the broker for the performance bond which would be required. McCloskey won, and selected Reynolds as the broker for the bond, on which McCloskey had paid a $73,631 premium, out of which Reynolds had, he said, kept $10,000 as a commission and paid $4,000 to Baker as what Reynolds was to describe as a payoff. And again, Reynolds produced for Williams documents that he said supported his story, an invoice for a $73,631 premium from the insurance firm through which Reynolds had secured the bond, his check to that firm for $63,631, the amount of the premium minus his $10,000 commission, and a personal check signed by Don B. Reynolds for $4,000, made out to and endorsed for deposit by Robert G. Baker. That was all Reynolds told Williams during that interview, but during another session, not long thereafter, he told the senator that there had also been another, more hidden side to the transaction, that the entire deal had been structured in such a way that it would provide not only the $4,000 payoff to Baker, but a $25,000 contribution to Lyndon Johnson's campaign for the Democratic presidential nomination. The amount of the premium had been $73,631, Reynolds said, but that hadn't been the amount that McCloskey and Company had actually paid. McCloskey had paid $109,205, with the understanding that of the approximately $35,000 overpayment, Reynolds would receive a second $10,000 for being the bag man, and the remaining $25,000 would be given to what Reynolds described as Mr. Johnson's campaign. Reynolds said he was instructed to deliver the money to Baker in cash, in installments that were never to be more than $5,000 each. He said he made three such deliveries, each of $50 bills, although, since the performance bond was not written until after the Democratic convention, McCloskey did not pay the $109,000 until October 17, 1960, and the cash was delivered not for Lyndon Johnson's campaign, but for the Johnson-Kennedy campaign. No explanation was given for the discrepancy between the $25,000 Reynolds was supposed to deliver and the $15,000 he actually delivered. If Reynolds's story was true, the district stadium deal violated at least three federal laws, one prohibiting political contributions of more than $3,000, one prohibiting corporations from making any political contributions at all, and one prohibiting the charging of a contribution to a government contract. Reynolds told Williams that he didn't have the check that would document his story. The $109,000 check from McCloskey and Company to be held up against the $73,000 bill to McCloskey and Company. But Williams would try to find a copy and would eventually succeed, obtaining a photostat of the check from someone, never identified, who wanted to cooperate with his investigation. Reynolds's story was therefore documented. And Baker would years later confirm it. Reynolds, who would later discuss other alleged transactions involving Lyndon Johnson and himself, exaggerated about some of them, Baker was to say, and made up others out of whole cloth. And it appears that Reynolds may indeed have done so. But he was apparently telling the truth about the McCloskey deal. "I was the man who put Reynolds and McCloskey together, so I know what the understandings were," Baker was to say. Reynolds told the truth with respect to the D.C. Stadium deal. McCloskey was later to admit the $35,000 overpayment, but said it had been merely a clerical error that had gone undetected until the Baker investigation started, that someone in his company had assumed the extra $35,000 was the premium on another insurance policy. "Somebody in our organization goofed. We make goofs like that every once in a while." And while Senator Williams did not, during that early November interview, learn the whole story of the stadium contract, Bobby Baker knew it. Knew it included the cash for the Lyndon Johnson campaign, and Johnson knew that Williams had been talking again to the insurance broker who had been central to it. Suddenly another link between him and Bobby Baker was on the verge of coming to light. On Wednesday, November 13th, the president convened the first major strategy session for the 1964 campaign in the Cabinet Room at the White House. It included the men who would be directing the campaign. From the family, the Attorney General and Stephen Smith, from the White House staff, O'Donnell, O'Brien, and Sorensen, from the Democratic National Committee, Chairman John Bailey and Richard McGuire, from the Census Bureau, Richard Scammon, an expert, in O'Donnell's words, on population trends with many interesting ideas on where to find the most Democratic votes. It was a long meeting, lasting from 4 o'clock until the president broke it up well after 7, saying he had a busy week ahead of him, and then, the next week, his trip to Texas. Lyndon Johnson was not at the meeting, and neither was any member of his staff, a fact that might have had no significance. A vice president is not invariably included in campaign strategy sessions. Except for two factors. First, the main topic of the meeting was the South, the difficulty of holding the gains made there in 1960, and the region's long-term future in the Democratic Party. And in 1960, the South had been his responsibility. Second, that there was such intense speculation over whether, in fact, he would be on the ticket. In these circumstances, his absence, as Arthur Schlesinger was to put it, led to a burst of talk, another burst, that the Kennedys were planning to dump Johnson. Such talk, Schlesinger says, was wrong. "The non-existence of any dump Johnson plan is fully and emphatically confirmed by Stephen Smith," he was to write. Johnson's place on the ticket was not discussed on November 13th because, barring illness or scandal, it was a given, is a summary in a book published in 1977 that is in line with that given in virtually all books on Kennedy or Johnson. But of course there had never been any discussion about putting Lyndon Johnson on the ticket in 1960. Not even with Bobby, until Jack Kennedy suddenly announced, to the astonishment of everyone, that he was doing so. And in fact, Evelyn Lincoln says that when, the morning after the strategy session, she was reading material from the meeting and Kennedy came over to her desk, he made a remark that contradicted his other quotes. She was to write that when she told the president that the 1964 convention wouldn't be as exciting as the 1960 version, because everyone knows what is coming, he replied, "Oh, I don't know, there might be a change in the ticket," before walking away. And, she wrote, when a week later Kennedy, sitting in a chair in her office, started talking about the reforms he wanted to make in government if he was re-elected, he said, "To do this I will need as a running mate in 64 a man who believes as I do. It is too early to make an announcement about another running mate. That will perhaps wait until the convention."